Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Guardian.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here, as in hearing, and here, as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello, this is Brexit Memes, The Guardian's weekly podcast on the seemingly unstoppable slow-motion car crash, or, depending on your point of view, the never-ending cornucopia of delights, that is, Brexit. I'm joking, of course. It's becoming harder and harder to argue that if things carry on as they're going, it isn't going to be a car crash. At least, that's if you believe the people who make the actual cars, who should presumably know something about it, but more of that later. So, as ever, plenty for us to chew on since last week. The government saw off the challenge of the last outstanding rebel Tory amendment on the EU withdrawal bill, the one about giving MPs a meaningful vote on what happens next if Parliament rejects the final Brexit deal after making a last-gasp concession. But it's only really kicked the can down the road and put off for another day the inevitable parliamentary showdown between Brexiters and Tory Remainers, with more crunch votes coming next month, particularly on keeping Britain in the or a customs union. So we'll be wondering how much longer the Prime Minister can get away with trying to keep everybody happy. Meanwhile, in what does start to feel like something of a step change, companies, and not the smallest ones, and their lobbies, are queuing up to warn of the cataclysmic consequences of the UK leaving the customs union. First there was Airbus, then BMW, then Siemens, then the CBI, all saying their British operations will be threatened, putting tens of thousands of jobs at risk if just-in-time delivery systems are messed with by customs or other controls at Britain's ports, and continental ports. And just this morning, as we were about to record this episode of Brexit Means, in fact, the SMMT, which is basically Britain's car industry, said investment had nearly halved and nearly 900,000 jobs were in play unless the government shifts its red lines. So business, it seems, really is starting to fight back. Then, not to forget, we had 100,000, or well over, according to many estimates, people taking part in a peaceful march demanding a people's vote on the final deal. The main battleground, of course, remains Parliament and Brussels. Let's not forget, there's a European Council summit at the end of the week that was once billed as a key moment in the Brexit process. But, you know, this march was at the very least heartening for the pro-European cause, and it certainly adds to the pressure on the government. So taken all together, I think the sort of the theme of this podcast is going to be the question, is the ground maybe starting to shift? Is Theresa May heading, as more and more people seem to think, towards a customs union and single market for goods but not services landing? And how would the EU, her own party's Brexiters and Leave voters cope? So with me to discuss all this are two people eminently qualified to make sense of it all, The Guardian's Brussels correspondent Jennifer Rankin and Jonathan Liss, deputy head of the think tank British Influence and an eloquent occasional commenter in the paper's pages as well. Welcome to both of you. Jonathan, let's start with this business question, shall we? Because it does feel like a bit of a moment. I mean, this is a very strong lineup of very serious businesses. Many, of course, with a strong European connection, beginning to ring the alarm bell rather loudly and making some very pointed criticisms of the government's Brexit approach. There's a particular irony, I suppose, of a German car maker coming out and saying it wouldn't be able to actually continue making cars in the UK if the government sticks to its positions. But, you know, is this the beginning? The Siemens, boss of Siemens, I think at the end of last week, summed it up quite well when he said, you know, that this feels like reality beginning to set in.
Yeah.
Is he right?
Absolutely. And we're going to have more of it. I suppose we're now at the business end of Brexit and the negotiations have to be wrapped up by October, which means that the government's utopian rainbow thinking eventually has to come to an end. And the can has been kicked down the road for the last year and a half. And eventually it has to actually find its destination. And so businesses have been sitting on their hands, if you like, for the last year, saying all this stuff in private, but too scared of the media, sort of the government strong arming to come out in public. And now you're always going to have a situation where the first people start their heads above the parapet and emboldened others to say the same. So we're going to expect
the floodgates open.
Exactly. So expect a lot of this in the coming weeks. And Theresa May has not done herself any favours when she insisted, Liam Fox as well, insisted after last week's vote that no deal was still firmly on the table. It couldn't have set a worse signal for business. And I think that might have been what finally prompted them to say, well, if you're going to not care about business, then why should we care about you? Why should we care about sort of sitting on our hands anymore? And so they are now saying, pointing out just simple facts, if we leave without a deal, that means that there is no point in them remaining here. There's no point in them investing here. The supply chains are ruined. There'll be tariffs automatically. Sort of standards will diverge. There is no point in them staying here when they could base their operations elsewhere.
Mm, exactly. I mean, that's a very good point that it is facts and not arguments, I suppose. The evidence really is beginning to stack up. We had that study in the FT who analysed an average of across several sort of economic models and that suggested that by the end of the first quarter of this year, the UK economy was 1.2% smaller than it would have been without the Brexit vote. That represents £24 billion hit to the economy, a Brexit cost of roughly £450 million a week. But, I mean, fascinating, really, the Brexiteers' response. Boris Johnson's four-letter expletive.
Absolutely.
Jeremy Hunt saying that Airbus's comments were completely inappropriate. You know, this from the so-called party of business. Are they getting rattled?
And
more
they
sort
are.
Of broadly, I mean, it occurred to me that the sort of the really interesting question behind this, maybe if we are thinking that we're getting towards a sort of a shift in attitudes, is it possible to say that maybe before the onus was sort of on the pro-EU proponents of what the Brexiters called Project Fear to sort of justify their doomsday scenarios. But now we're gradually moving to a place where the onus is shifting and it might now be the turn of the Brexiters to have to kind of justify what you might call their Project Fantasy.
You're absolutely right, John, and that is why we're seeing this backlash. That's why we're seeing these sort of rattled interventions, as you point out. And Jeremy Hunt, who now calls himself a Brexiter, Boris Johnson saying, fuck business. Of course, when he says that, what he's really saying is fuck workers, fuck jobs, fuck the economy, to which the rich people might say, well, fuck you. And so it's very, very difficult for them to maintain those lines when the evidence is beginning to mount. And of course, it's really important for people to understand that after this week, when we have the June EU Council summit, which very little is expected to be agreed on the main meat and bones, we then have one final summit, and that's the summit where everything has to be signed off. So whatever doesn't get agreed now has to be agreed then, and that gives 4 months to square these unsquareable circles. And a lot of the Brexiteers know this, and that's why they're desperately trying to lash out, channel the rage, point people in another direction, blame business of all people, blame Remainers, blame immigrants, the usual suspects, when really we need to be casting the blame a little bit closer to home. And why is it that the party of business, as you say, should be telling business, leave this country? The Conservative Party is a party of business. That's extraordinary anyway, but the fact that so many people's jobs depend on that. And the poorest areas in Britain will be the hardest hit by that. A lot of Leave areas makes it even more unforgivable.
Jennifer, as Jonathan mentioned, we are but 2 days away from a summit, aren't we? And the EU ministers are in Luxembourg right now preparing that council meeting in Brussels on Thursday and Friday. Now, just a few weeks ago, everybody was calling it a crunch summit for Brexit. I mean, how much time will Brexit actually take up on Thursday and Friday, do you think? I mean, there is still no Brexit white paper from the British government, which still doesn't know what it wants from Brexit. And the summit agenda has been hijacked by other things, hasn't it? I mean, thinking of the sort of the immigration or the political immigration crisis, an actual immigration crisis, but the political crisis over immigration. What place will Brexit actually occupy on the summit agenda?
Well, not very much. I mean, my prediction would be that on Friday morning, EU leaders will perhaps talk this over for about an hour, and they will sign off some pre-prepared conclusions, giving a not too subtle warning to the British government that they haven't made enough progress and they really need to speed up and be more realistic about what agreement they might strike with the EU. But I don't think EU leaders will be devoting very much time to this at all. It's certainly not uppermost in people's minds here and in EU capitals. And I think these days the only people who are calling it a crunch summit are Conservative government ministers or backbenchers. And I'm sort of struck every time I switch on the British radio, the BBC, and hear ministers making these kind of statements that Theresa May will be going off to Brussels with, you know, to strike a deal. Well, that's really far from the case, and she won't be negotiating Brexit at all. It's possible she will update EU leaders on Thursday, but usually this kind of update is relegated to a few minutes over coffee and petit four at the end of a dinner. But it's really not on the EU's agenda. As you say, the big dominant theme of this summit is going to be all about migration, and as you rightly say, it's a political crisis. It's not a crisis over numbers, but that's really at the foremost of EU leaders' minds, and I think they're quite happy for Michel Barnier to do the technical heavy work on Brexit, and they're happy to sign off on what he thinks they should be saying.
Well, I mean, do we have any? I mean, you say there might be we might hear some kind of a warning. I mean, do we have any idea what that might say? And what does that, assuming there is no progress, concrete progress made, which seems very likely, what are the key areas that are left to decide before October?
Well, the draft conclusions that we've seen show that EU leaders will express their concern that no substantial progress has yet been achieved on agreeing a backstop on Ireland. So it does all come back to Ireland again, the circle that can't be squared when it comes to the customs union and avoiding a hard border on the island of Ireland. So that's a big worry for everyone. And I think there will be a warning to the British government to show more realism about how they're approaching these negotiations. I think there's a very strong sense from the negotiating team in Brussels that the political reality hasn't bitten yet for the government, that they continue to think they can have all sorts of access to the single market that simply won't be available to the UK as a non-EU member state. So I think EU leaders will really sort of seek to hammer that message home in their official conclusions.
Right. Yes. Now, Jonathan, you're not very confident of any progress until those British red lines shift.
Absolutely, as Jennifer just said. There are three red lines that the government has put down which make this circle completely unsquareable, which are free movement of people, trade deals with third countries, and jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. The EU can say as many times as it likes, you can't sort of get a deal and still retain those red lines, but the government won't listen until it has to listen. And so there seems to be an idea that the EU will let Britain off this time. They're not going to say Brexit can't be done, but they're going to sound this warning and then just give, in a way, the UK government more rope to hang itself. Because what you really have, ultimately, is two very clear options. I'd be interested to see if Jennifer agrees with this, but you either have a sea border between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, in which Northern Ireland remains in the customs union and a single market for goods, and that means that goods will either have to be checked for regulations, or regulations and tariffs, depending on if we're in the customs union as well, from goods arriving from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. The alternative to that is that the whole UK stays in the whole customs union and the whole single market. Because if the UK, what the UK is trying to do at the moment, is extend the backstop from Northern Ireland to the whole UK, the EU says you can't do that because that's cherry-picking the single market. So this whole idea of single market for goods, it just won't mush. We'll have to be in the whole single market, and that means, you guessed it, free movement to people.
Jennifer, is it as simple as that?
Well, I haven't heard anyone in Brussels come up with a different proposal, and I think that, and I think Donovan said out very clearly what the choices are and the starkness of the choices. And yes, there does seem to be increasing optimism in London that there will be some kind of landing zone on the single market for goods, with some flexibility on free movement of people, and maybe the UK makes a concession on services. But that's not what I'm hearing from officials in Brussels. They don't look very kindly on that option. Again, they see it as cherry picking. They see it as the UK trying to have its cake and eat it. It comes back to the integrity of the single market, these themes that the EU has been stressing all along. And I really think it's getting to the point where the government simply has to make a choice.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit about the sort of catastrophe scenario, because there has also been a lot of talk, and from both sides over the past few days, about preparations or not for a no deal. Jonathan David Davis said last week that insisted the government's, you know, doing a lot to prepare for a no deal. Liam Fox says the UK is absolutely ready to walk away. I mean, is this serious?
No. Totally, totally insane. They know it is. This is game playing, and it's you can sometimes allow politicians their games, but not when thousands of jobs depend on it. Not when the economy depends on it. This is totally unforgivable, and it's also unprecedented. No deal. You can't say this enough. No deal means that planes will not be able to fly between the UK and the EU. That is all there is to it, because you fall out of the aviation mechanisms. It means that you risk radiotherapy patients and not having access to radioisotopes because they get stuck at the border, and also because we fall out of Euratom. It means that the pound plunges. It means that recession is guaranteed. It means that jobs are lost overnight. This is what it means for a government to even entertain such a proposal. It's totally extraordinary. And it also is counterproductive, because it just makes the EU think that we're not serious, because the EU knows that the UK can't threaten this realistically. And the more that it does threaten it, you either have to ask, well, are they serious, or are they just really bad bluffers? If they're serious, it's a disaster. And if they're really bad bluffers, it's a disaster, because it means that we can't negotiate with these people. They're not serious.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Jennifer Jean-Claude Juncker also said last week that the bloc had to be realistic about what he described as the dangerous state of the negotiation. Is that also where the EU is coming from? Are officials really counting on talks breaking down, or the possibility of talks breaking down altogether, do you think?
I think people are more worried about it than they were 2 months ago, say. And when they do hear this kind of talk from Liam Fox and others, yes, they might see it as game playing, but they also do see it as elevating the risk of a no-deal Brexit. Although I think the odds-on assumption is that the UK will negotiate a deal with the EU, but nonetheless that risk of a no deal has gone up, and the EU as a consequence is preparing for that. So they are looking at flexibility and financial rules, at how the EU budget could be used to help countries that might be hit by the brunt of a no deal Brexit, especially Ireland, Belgium, the Netherlands. These are all the countries in people's minds that have the most to lose on the EU side. So I think they are counting on talks to conclude with a deal, but nonetheless this threat is being taken very seriously.
The EU will obviously look at the evidence that the UK has given them so far. As in any game, you look at how the player has acted in the past, and you have seen since the negotiations started that the UK has promised everything from the very first day, when you say we're going to have the row of the summer over sequencing, and then capitulated that day. And so we've seen, as in December before the joint report, when the UK capitulated, so the UK ultimately gives
up. It caves down at every step.
It caves in at the last minute. And it's really odd, because you would have a lot more credibility if you sort of caved gradually so people didn't know you were caving. But instead, you kind of put on this show about how we're going to beat those Europeans, and at the last minute, then you cave, which you might have foreseen before you did it. And so the EU has... that you might obviously think that things could go badly, but at the same time you could see the evidence, which is that the UK is not going to sort of carry out its bluffs.
Yes, although on the point about caving in is a really interesting one, because when the UK caved in December on the financial settlement on paying the EU money, and when it caved in in March on agreeing to the EU's terms of a transition, there was still a certain amount of ambiguity about the final deal. And we are going to get to a point soon, very soon, where all the ambiguity will have to be stripped away. And then, so that's, I think for EU officials, that raises the question, you know, will the UK continue on this trend of always sort of talking very ferociously and then finally caving in? And it does sort of raise a bit more uncertainty in people's minds whether that will happen again. But yes, they certainly see that the UK has threatened before to leave the table, and then, well, really for the EU, that's seen as an empty threat.
Yes. I mean, I suppose it does all come down really to the crunch question is when is, as you say, Jennifer, that ambiguity finally going to be stripped away? And there are some hopes, I don't know whether they are realistic or not, that some things might be resolved, at least at this famous sort of war cabinet away day gathering that's scheduled for Chequers, the Prime Minister's country retreat at the beginning of next month. Because, you know, the root problem, obviously, is, as we've been saying all along, the government's utter inability to sort of get off the fence and actually say what kind of Brexit it wants and can realistically expect the EU to accept. Now, Jonathan, we mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you could just sort of unpick it a little bit, if you would. There's been quite a lot of speculation, hasn't there, over the last few days, and quite a lot of priming by Whitehall officials promoting it, that, you know, Theresa May is hopefully heading towards some kind of sort of landing strip that looks a bit like staying in the customs union and trying to be in a single market for goods with some kind of divergence allowed on services. Now, that's simply not going to wash as far as you're concerned.
I don't see why the EU would allow it. It doesn't have to. The EU has been very clear that from the very beginning that you can't have one freedom of the single market without having all four freedoms. And so the UK to ask for the single market and goods is a total sort of negation of that. But also it doesn't make any sense to the UK perspective either, because the UK obviously depends on services. Mm. So the UK, that means the UK gets terrible 80% deals on
of
services.
Its economy.
Yeah. Exactly. And also it's really like the whole point of the UK staying outside the customs union, what the UK has always wanted, is to have these mythical trade deals with third countries. Now, if you're in the single market for goods, that means that you have to keep your regulations tied. That limits what you can do with other countries. And if you're in the customs union, that obviously limits the tariffs. So that in practice, it means that you can only have deals with third countries based on services anyway, which a lot of countries wouldn't even begin to entertain. Countries like China and the US aren't really interested in that for the UK.
Right. Jennifer, is that something that the EU would ever entertain, a kind of a split single market?
I can't see it happening, and there's no sign that in EU member states or in the institutions that anyone is prepared to entertain that idea. There's a real fear about destroying the single market by 1,000 cuts, by giving the UK such a special deal that then the EU member states no longer want to sign up to all the rules. And I think that logic, which was true on the 24th of June 2016 when the EU gave its initial response to the referendum, is still true today, 2 years later. There's no sign that the EU is willing to compromise in this way.
Just on this issue about any negotiation, a negotiating partner will offer what it feels it has to offer. The EU is in such a strong position and the UK is in such a weak position that the EU does not need to offer the UK sort of bits of the single market, because it doesn't have to. The EU has made its offer, which is the whole single market or none of it, effectively. And the UK has so few cards over the EU, in fact none, that it's in no position to ask for anything else. And that is really the overriding point. It's all about power dynamics. The EU will offer what it has to offer. It doesn't have to offer this.
Mm. Okay, well, none of that looks particularly promising. I mean, one thing that was uplifting over the last few days, the weekend, was the People's March. It was, you know, it was a joyous occasion, I have to say, given the context, and impressive in terms of numbers. It takes quite a lot to get 100,000 more Brits onto the streets, and many of them coming from all over the UK, and certainly from well outside the sort of elite metropolitan bubble that Remainers are often accused of belonging to. Jonathan, ponder that for a little bit. I mean, I suppose the real question is, will it change anything?
I think that people always ask this question about marches, don't they? I mean, I went and I had a great time. It felt very festive, as you say. I think it's about signalling and messaging, and if you have a momentum and other people join in, you know, it's interesting that this week we're seeing a left-wing group made up of former Momentum leaders, for example, calling for a people's vote. I just wrote a piece in Prospect last week, a little plug, about how you could win a referendum from the left. It could not be a repeat of the 2016 campaign. It would have to show show people that it shared their concerns, it was on their side, and that it was tackling issues such as austerity and the crisis in the health service, education and so on, and that leaving the EU wasn't the answer. And so it really would have to be a people's campaign that wasn't sort of talking in abstract terms, but it was really addressing the concerns people have as in a general election campaign. But of course, it's a huge uphill struggle because neither the Conservative front bench nor the Labour front bench is currently in favour of it. And you'd have to have a huge change in public opinion. And at the moment, those things are slow to appear.
Mm. But certainly adding pressure, the general sort of atmosphere of pressure on the government, you'd have
to
say.
Absolutely.
Taken in conjunction with, you know, these business warnings, the possibility of further parliamentary rebellions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all beginning to sort of...
The vortex is
beginning to speed up.
Everything is coalescing. And because, and I'm glad that Jennifer agrees with that assessment, that May is going to be trapped by two possibilities. Either sea border, which the DUP may well try to bring her down over, along with a lot of Conservatives and Labour, the Labour MPs as well, because that splits the UK's internal market, or a fully soft Brexit, which would be unacceptable to the Brexiteers in the Tory party. So she might not be long for this prime ministerial world, and that sort of changes everything, because then you have a Brexit in complete free fall. There'll be a lot of demands, possibly on both sides actually, to change course, and then the demand for a people's vote could become irresistible.
I mean, oddly, Jennifer, I would imagine, I mean, Brussels wouldn't welcome a change of government, would it?
Well, I think officially they would never say that, but you know, unofficially, of course, I think it would throw everything into confusion, and there's already an awful lot of confusion about the process. I mean, I think in general Brussels would welcome the UK reversing its decision and deciding to stay in the EU, but nobody thinks that's going to happen, and that the march that happened in the weekend, it was certainly noted, and people have taken great interest in it. It's one of the great ironies of Brexit now that in the UK we have the most active pro-EU movement than probably any other country in the EU at the moment. but nonetheless, people like Donald Tusk, they talk to Theresa May, and Theresa May and other government ministers, what they are telling the EU side is that, you know, that the will of the people requires Brexit to happen, and that everything flows from that vote on the 23rd of June 2 years ago. And as a result, nobody takes seriously the idea that the UK is going to reverse its decision, and Brexit is seen as almost inevitable, something regrettable, but something now that is very unlikely to be reversed.
But just the point in that, the EU has been clear, as Jennifer said, that they would welcome us a change in decision. And so that's one of the arguments out of the way. We can then ask for an extension of Article 50 in order to have the referendum, and then if necessary the EU would allow us to revoke Article 50. So there are sort of a lot of roadblocks have been cleared, and so that there is still a way forward. The difficulty is, if we go after March 2019, go into a transition period and then try to rejoin the EU, there might be a lot of obstacles put in our way, such as, you know, the requirements to join the Euro, Schengen and so on, and that's something that we have to bear in mind as a difficulty.
All right, well, that is about it for this week, I'm afraid. My thanks to Jonathan and to Jennifer for joining me. Please do subscribe and review on all of your favourite podcatchers as ever. Join the discussion on Twitter. You just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. If you want to get in touch, it's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Please keep those emails coming. Till next week then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Max Sanderson. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.